Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. So many people I've talked with lately say that with everything going on in the world, with the pandemic, the protests, and here in the US, the political rants that are dividing not only our country, but families and friends, it's a very difficult, very challenging time. And some people are starting to struggle. Others have been struggling for a long time. But, you know, we're all having to cope in our own way. So I'm very pleased to welcome someone today who can help provide some positive solutions, because that's what we're about. He's one of my favorite psychologists. He's an expert in mind, body, spirit, and psychology. And I'm talking, of course, of Dr. Joseph Cardillo. He's been on the show several times before, and we're welcoming him back today to talk about his new book. I'll give you the title of that in just a second. Today, we'll talk about the difference between mindfulness and attention. To be honest, I'd always lumped those two together, thinking they were one and the same, but they're really not. And Dr. Joe explains that, and the way he explains it helped me realize there's quite a significant difference between mindfulness and attention. And once we recognize that, it can make a very big impact on our happiness, and it can help us improve things at work and in life in general. So today we also look at why we should talk to our brain and what that can do for us, and what we can learn from nature. So Dr. Joseph Cardillo is a top-selling author in the fields of health, mind, body, spirit, and psychology. He's an expert in attention training and has taught his methods to more than 20,000 students at various colleges, universities, and institutions. He holds a PhD in holistic psychology and mind-body medicine, and his work regularly appears in Psychology Today and other publications. And the book we're talking about today, brand new, hot off the presses, is called The 12 Rules of Attention: How to Avoid Screw-Ups, Free Up Headspace, Do More, and Be More at Work. But again, I want to stress, this is not just about work. These are methods you can apply to everyday life. All right, here's my guest, Dr. Joseph Cardillo. So, Dr. Joe Cardillo, welcome back. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you're one of our favorites here. I love your energy and the things you write and talk about. And today, of course, we're talking about your new book, 12 Rules of Attention: How to Avoid Screw-Ups, Free Up Headspace, Do More, and Be More at Work. So a very timely book, given that we're living in such unusually challenging times right now. And, you know, I talk with many people who are extremely successful and disciplined, and even they are saying it's a struggle to focus. So are you finding people telling you that, and how's it going for you?
Well, it's a struggle for me too. It's a struggle for everybody right now. I mean, you couldn't have said it any better. These are just really difficult times, and you know, it was predictable that people, if it kept, you know, if everything that's happened kept going, which it has, it was predictable that, you know, would affect, you know, the way we think and feel and behave throughout the day.
Yeah, and I think it wouldn't be so bad if we had an end in sight, but we really don't. We're kind of resurging back again, you know, with the virus, at least that's going up again. So, you know, it's like, I think that's one of the things that's very difficult for people. So I'm really glad we get the opportunity of talking to you today. And lots of great information in the book. So let's dive right in here. And you begin the book with the cost of the attention equation. And you say, simply put, that attention is connected to every single thing you think, feel, and do at work and elsewhere. And there are a couple of sides to the attention equation, as you call it: the cost of inattention to businesses, and of course, the cost to ourselves as human beings. So let's look at first at the business costs here. And you talk in the book about a pay scale survey that was done recently by over 60,000 managers, and they reported that 56% of college grads don't pay attention to detail at work. And it also estimated that companies in the United States pay a whopping $650 billion per year for errors attributed to employee distraction. So what's going on there? Why are we? I mean, we are distracted. Yeah.
Just amazing. So, you know, what's going on there is the rest of the book. but what's going on there is that people are not paying attention. And there are reasons for that. And I think, you know, I'm thinking as I say it, you're probably going to bring it up if I don't, so I might as well bring it up right now. I think that we've been getting away with this for well over a decade, probably going on two decades. We've been blaming technology, right, for this lack of attention. And although, you know, I got to say, I agree with everybody else who is saying that, you know, technology, particularly cell phones and those kind of devices and so on, you know, are really not the greatest thing for children. I agree with that wholeheartedly. You know, for adults, you know, I think I have a different opinion on that. And I don't think that we can blame technology for this great loss of attention. I think it's something more organic. And I think, you know, until we address that, we're never going to correct this, this attention problem that we're having, this focus-starved brain.
Yes, I was surprised to when I read in the book you said exactly that you know, technology has some blame there, but you don't blame it for everything, and there's more meat to this story than just technology.
Yeah,
because you know I work with tech companies. I've worked with them in the past quite a bit, and they certainly throw a lot of stuff at you and expect instant attention and instant responses and pop-ups this and chat boxes that. Constantly you've got this stream of stuff. So we'll get into this more, obviously, because, you know, as you said, you've 12 rules of attention here that we can address. But so let's talk a little bit about our brain, because you say it makes decisions for us all day long. Most of us are totally unaware that the brain is making these decisions for us subconsciously. So what's going on under the radar there that we need to be aware of?
Well, one of the things that you know I point out in the book is that anywhere around 96% of what we do all day is being decided for us by the way our mind is preset to operate throughout the day. And so we really rely on that mechanism. Now, I'm not saying that as a negative. I'm saying that we need this attentional network in our heads in order to function throughout the day. You know, and it really is not difficult to understand. I mean, if we had to rethink everything that we do or relearn everything that we do, remember all the steps, for example, of how to drive a car, you know, you know, we'd be there forever. Yeah. All day long, we'd get nothing done. So most of what we do, you know, thanks to evolution, probably thanks to evolution, has been, you know, preset for us by the habits that we've created and some by the habits that we've been taught.
Right, and you say that our brain's attentional system can determine whether we feel depressed or spirited, how we experience others and how they experience us, and even the depth and frequency and accuracy of our insights.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I've been working in the mind-body business for almost three decades now, and you know, one of the things that I'm realizing more and more is how important a role attention plays in all of that. I mean, it's really at the core of everything that we do. So, you know, when we're, you know, feeling blah, or we're feeling down or depressed, you know, it's not, an unlikely candidate is, you know, very few people say, well, I think my attention or my focus is off. We don't even consider that. You know, we consider a lot of other things, but we don't consider that. But oftentimes, it's the culprit.
Right.
Or, you know, when we have an unexpected good day.
Right.
You know, and really nice things happen to us. Very few people will sit there and say, I wonder if I paid attention to something a little differently today and thus occurred. See, because if we did do that, those kind of things, we would figure out what is happening in our focus, what we're focused on, whether it's internal or external, that's creating the bummers, so to speak. And we would also figure out what things we focused on that created the positive things that happened to us on a day. But we just kind of take it. You know, when something bad happens, we just kind of say, geez, you know, that was terrible. I hope it doesn't happen again. And when something good happens, hardly anybody tries to figure out why.
Right.
You know, so that we can repeat it. But it's all, you know, trust me, it's all in your attentional network. And if you're not paying, if we don't pay attention to what's causing the ups and downs, our mind is paying attention to it. You know, our neurons are paying attention to it, and they're gonna download it, they're gonna save it, and the next time we're in a similar experience, they're gonna behave thusly. And that's why we get into those ruts.
Right. Well, talking of ruts, let's look at the other side of the attention equation, which of course is ourselves and how productive, happy, and fulfilled we feel at work and at home, in life in general. And I just wanted to share these numbers because they're quite staggering. 55% of workers in the US report feeling stressed on their job. This is according to the Gallup poll. And more than half of US workers are dissatisfied with their jobs, and probably not any surprise there. 82% of us feel our strongest talents go wasted in the workplace. That is really sad.
Absolutely. And you know, along with the talents, you know, the, you know, 80% of people feel that whatever it is that they do best, their employers don't even have a clue as to what that is. And that's sad. And it's sad for that 80%, I think it's actually 82% of individuals, because they're not getting they're not getting fulfilled on a daily basis. And I think I wrote the book. I wrote the book for organizations and institutions and corporations, so that, you know, there would be less worker error. Yes, I wrote the book for that, but the entire book is really focused on the individual.
Yes.
And you know, how can we be happier with what we do on a daily basis, whatever your work is?
Yeah.
You know, even if you're retired, you know, with what you're doing, how can you be happier? How can you sync that up with what's inside of you and make sure that's happening on the outside as well?
Right. Well, again, I think this is so timely because, you know, we're going to be facing this new normal, and none of us knows what that looks like or you know, how long we're going to be in the situation. So the more we can work on this now, I think, the better. So let's look at rule number one. You say talk to your brain. I mean, are you literally saying there, you know, just have a little conversation with your brain? I know you have some exercises in the book. I looked at them, but explain that to our listeners.
Yeah, I think I have some exercises in the book that do reflect a sort of self-talk. I call it a self-scan to kind of figure out where you are at the moment and what you need to be doing and things like that. But one of the things that I think that we can do, if we do nothing else to try to improve our attention, is to talk to our brain in a language that it understands. So if you didn't talk to your brain at all, it's trying to figure out, your brain wants to be your friend, and so it's trying to figure out what you need. And one of its most desirable languages is repetition. So since most people don't really talk to their brain and tell their brain what they need, your brain tries to figure it out through the things that you do.
Right.
You know, not that different than what Google does.
Right.
You know, not that different. You know, Google figures out what things you do, and then it offers you a menu of things that it thinks that you're interested in. Well, your brain does a similar thing. It's kind of, if you'll follow if we can use the metaphor, it'll just kind of watch what you're doing all day long, and the things that you do repetitiously, it assumes are the things that you like to do, and it tries to find a way to get you to do those things quicker and more efficiently,
right?
Whether they're good or bad, because
right.
It doesn't really qualify it that way. It's just looking at what it thinks you want to do, and then it'll help repeat that pattern. So if it thinks you want to get to work in if it thinks that you want to get to work in a peaceful, calm mindset, then it'll do that for you. But if every day we get into traffic and, you know, we get stressed out by that traffic and we do it repeatedly, then our brain starts to pick that message up and it'll stress us out before anything ever even happens to stress us out.
Right. So that saying, you know, focus goes where attention goes, is really very true in many ways. And I do hope that our brains work more effectively than Google, because they show me stuff I am not at all interested in. I don't know how that happens. Probably because I do a lot of research. I don't know. Okay, so talk to us a little bit about the power of visualization, because that's another thing that I've always been big into, because I grew up with athletic parents, you know, and they always say envision the ball and blah, blah, blah. So what do you mean by visualization as far as this?
Well, visualization's a great thing. I'm going to just bounce back for a second to what you're saying about Google, because I thought that was really fun. When our brains do that to us too, they show us a lot of things we don't want to see. So, for example, we go in shopping and we got one item in mind. I went to the store to get a particular item. You know, all of us have done that. We go there and we buy everything except.
Right.
You know, if you're like me, you drive all the way home and you find out, oh my gosh, I didn't buy the one thing I went there to buy.
Right.
You know, but my brain showed me everything else that it thought I might be interested in aside from that. So my first rule in the book was, in fact, to pay attention to how we're paying attention. So, you know, if I use the store story, when I go to the store and something like that happens, I might ask myself, you know, why was I paying attention to the milk and cookies instead of the sugar that I wanted to buy, or the milk, or something else? You know, why was I paying attention to something else other than what I intended to buy? And you could start with that and kind of backtrack and see if you can follow your footsteps and figure out what sent you, you know, awry.
Yeah. You said in the book somewhere that scientists believe our attentional decline is the result of idiocracy, and I love that. So what do you think about that? Do you agree with them? And
I totally agree. You know, we have these things that we just believe them. You know, one of the things that we believe is that, no pain, no gain.
Right.
You know, we say that. Now, I know that in athletics that doesn't work that way. You know, if you have pain after doing a particular athletic activity and you keep pursuing it, you know, you're liable to injure yourself maybe for a long time.
Right, right.
So those are some of the things, you know. Or, you know, we have some of these beliefs. Well, you know, my grandfather always did it this way.
Yes.
Yeah, but is that the situation that you're in now? You know, or That kind of thing.
Mm. And so, going back to visualization again, you say it's a great energy booster. Why is it a great energy booster for us?
Well, visualization's fantastic. This is a skill that's been in Eastern meditative arts for centuries. And now it seems to be making a big splash in Western medicine, you know, at least in the last decade, a really big splash. It's a major tool, because visualization allows us to practice an experience before it actually happens, and decide for ourselves which way we want to act within that experience. And once we preset that pattern. So once I say this is the way, you know, going back to that store story, you know, if I don't want to do that again, if I can if in a visualization, if I'm reflecting after the experience, how I went to the store and how I picked up something I didn't want to, really I wasn't even interested in picking up and didn't pick up the thing I was interested, if I can find out what misled me, then I can practice in my head, I can visualize going to the store and behaving the way I want to behave. And, you know, of course, that could be work, that could be home. You could extend that story into any element of your life. So you're visualizing yourself behaving the way you want to behave. And what that does is it eliminates the old links that are in the experience that your brain would engage all on its own. It eliminates those. It talks to the brain and lets the brain know this is the way you want to behave, because you're practicing the visualization, you know, over and over again.
Yeah, interesting.
And then the next time you're in an opportunity like that, your brain will engage those behaviors in a millisecond. That's how quick it'll happen.
Right, right. I mean, I do know it's powerful because I've tested it myself, and I should obviously use it a lot more than I do.
What happens is every time we enter an experience, whatever it is, you know, it could be something very serious. It doesn't have to be entering the store. It could be a contract negotiation. It could be anything at all. Whenever we enter an experience, our brain sets up a mini experience really fast in milliseconds. It sets up a mini experience that gives a sort of synopsis as to what it thinks is going to happen in that experience.
Right.
So you're kind of getting like a preview of the whole experience in a millisecond. And from that, it goes through all of its memory files and picks out the possible solutions that you'll need to have a successful experience. And it bases that on patterns of behavior that we've repeated often in our past. And then it brings those things forward, and we pick one of those and we act on it. And it sounds like a lot, but it actually happens in milliseconds. So if, for example, somebody passes you on the freeway and cuts you off, and your brain sets up that mini experience, and it goes and gathers all the previous behaviors, and you engage one, then you might find yourself, you know, yelling at the person or gesticulating at the person who cut you off, and you're not even thinking about it. You're just doing it. It's an automatic. It's one of those 96% behaviors that's happening under your radar.
Wow. Yeah, definitely worth practicing that. So awareness. Let's talk about awareness, mindfulness, and attention, because I think many people use those words interchangeably, and you say they're not the same. And we need to
that
be very aware of
that. That was one of the favorite points in my book for me, actually.
Hmm. So could you just, on a high level, say why they're not the same and what we need to be aware of?
Okay. So I'll start with awareness. I can be aware of something and not pay attention to it. So I can know, for example, I can be sitting in my office and know that I have a pot of coffee brewing in the kitchen, or I could be sitting in my office and know that my daughter is practicing piano in the living room. Even though I can't hear her or see her, I know that she's there. So awareness is something that's different from attention. It's related and associated with attention because I can pay attention to it later, but it's not necessarily attention. If you're driving a car, you can be aware that there is going to be a hairpin turn coming up in about a mile, but you're not paying attention to it. It hasn't even happened yet, but you can be aware of it.
Okay, makes sense.
So that's awareness. Mindfulness, which is one of these terms that I love to define because we use it so much. Mindfulness is really an element of energy. I know a lot of people want to define mindfulness as presence, but you could be quite present and not paying attention to anything at all. So mindfulness is something a little more than presence. You can be present and your focus and attention could be very dull. Mindfulness is the energy within presence, if you will. And one way I can explain that is on our cell phones, we all have a sort of a toggle switch that we can slide up and down and increase the brightness of the phone and also increase the brightness of the flashlight that comes with most cell phones. And mindfulness is like that to presence. So if we can stop for a moment and examine how present are we really at a particular moment, and then think of mindfulness as increasing the light beam of that presence, just like you would increase the light beam on your cell phone. And then attention is a brain network that works like an information gathering system. And so what you have is you encounter an experience, and your attentional system is filing through your memories, your emotions, your past procedures, and coming up with a solution for you on a particular problem.
Okay, makes sense. And so ideally we should learn to integrate all three of those because...
And then you have to integrate all three. So if you want to be highly attentive and highly focused, you want to turn up your mindfulness beam, you want to turn up your energy that you're using to focus on something, and you also, when you can use your awareness, and I talk about this in the book a lot, you can use your awareness to preset what you're going to pay attention to. So for example, if I'm aware that there's going to be a hairpin turn in a mile, then when it comes up, I will be more attuned to paying attention to that. And I could explain, and in the book I do explain how that works. It actually puts more glue on your focus.
Right.
So as the elements of that hairpin turn are coming into your attention, your brain will hold the focus on that particular element longer and recognize it as the hairpin turn quicker.
Okay.
Than it would if you weren't aware of it at all. So you can use pre-awareness in a visualization. You can put those two things together. And the visualization can make you pre-aware, and pre-awareness makes your attention tighten up on certain detail. And if it's a detail that you want, well, then it's a win-win.
Makes sense. And I've never heard mindfulness described that way before, but it makes perfect sense. So thank you for taking the time to do that. I want to share these facts because I thought they were kind of fun things, right? You say learn from the big and small yet amazing brains in nature. And I love this section. For example, what can we learn from bees about learning and memory?
Well, I had a great time writing that section. I'm glad that you're bringing that out. I just really had a great time doing that. And at first I thought it was going to be kind of like a rest in the book. But then I said, no, this is really a fun section because we live with all these little creatures and also big creatures. And sometimes we wonder, what are they thinking in there?
Right.
So, I looked at bees. And bees are really remarkable animals. I mean, bees can recognize your face. So you got to be careful if you're swatting at it.
Wow, yeah, really?
They can recognize your face. They've got an incredible sense of smell. But one thing that bees do they talk to each other. They have a dance called the waggle dance, which is kind of like their language. But another thing that bees do that we can learn from is bees use color association, and they're quicker at it than we are. those little tiny brains, the size of a pinhead, are quicker at organizing and recognizing color than we are. So, for example, a bee could, you know, a whole meadow away identify, you know, which of the flowers is going to give it the best pollen.
Interesting.
Based on its color, which is very different, you know, from the way we of course, we don't think that way, but we could start using color as an association for ourselves as well. I have a friend who organizes his entire library by color.
Yes, I know people who do that too.
Yeah, he remembers, when he tries to remember a book, he can't remember the whole title or even the author, but he can remember, oh, it was the red one.
It's the red section, it's the white section.
Yeah. You know, years ago, you know, I was a big fan of Muhammad Ali, and Muhammad Ali, you know, had a, you know, he called himself a poet, and one of the lines that he used to use all the time that he made up was "float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. You can't hit what you can't see."
Right.
That's the way it went.
Right.
But you know, so I looked at that line and I said, you know, when Ali was saying that, of course the media loved it, but when Ali was saying that, he called it poetry, but he also called it scientific boxing, and everybody thought he was kidding. You know, they said, oh, well, you know, it's poetry, it's fun, it makes for good media. But, you know, now we look at things like that through the lens of visualization, and we realize it really can establish patterns that are, you know, neurological and muscular.
Right, right.
So, you know, there was more to what he was saying.
Oh, yeah. The
message,
I
mean, poetry.
Yeah, I believe that. So I've got a couple more questions I really want to get in, and I know we don't have a great deal of time here, but there's so much interesting stuff in the book to talk about. So I want to skip ahead to something that I think is really important, given all of our overload and data overflow, and you know, we've got internal distractions, external distractions, and we've got more than enough going on politically, virus-wise, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So how can I personally, how can we as humans try and reduce that head clutter and strengthen our attention span?
Well, you know, I think that one of the ways I talk about reducing head clutter in the book, there's a couple of ways that we can do this. First, we can use everything in attention, and I think it becomes a kind of a mantra in the book, really. Everything about attention has a good and also a bad side to it. Just about everything. And so, you know, you think, well, you know, a distraction is something bad, which it is. But if you cut out all distractions, you might miss something good.
Mm.
So, there's a good and bad side to everything. So when I talk about the 96% of our behavior that's kind of robotic, and instigated by previous behaviors, and we kind of act through those things without much thought, one gets the idea that might be something bad, but it isn't really bad. It's good. Those kind of circuits that are operating in us that make us act out of habit all day long are good circuits. We need those circuits because they're the things that enable us to get rid of distractors. So if I can use a visualization to identify a distractor and create a mental habit of every time I see that particular distractor, I'm going to get rid of it. And if I do that mentally enough times with a visualization, then when that particular distractor comes up in real life, I'll ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I'll be disposed to ignore it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then the nice thing is you can always change it back. Can always create an instant behavior that'll bring it back if you need it. So visualization is a way that we can use to create circuits that'll make us operate the way we want to operate in a given situation. And so the more automatic we can make our behaviors so that they fit our goals, the more headspace we'll have, because we've kind of like, you know, if our mind was a computer, we've cleared out a lot of the activity that leads to discovering the solution, and made the solution automatic. And so we've got all that extra headspace to address other things. So really, it's got a lot to do with visualizations, with reflection, with creating behaviors that are suited to our goals before we approach them.
Right.
And I teach people how to do that in my book. It's a big thing. It's always been a big thing in athletics.
Yes, very big. And so I want to end with Rule 12, which you say we've been talking about the brain, we've been talking about behaviors, we've talked about, you know, work situations, but you say keep a little soul. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I mean everything that says, I guess. We have to keep some time for ourselves, and that whole rule number 12 is don't forget at the end of the day. And I give a whole evening program at the end of the day to do things to specifically cool off the circuits that you've been burning hot all day long. So that's what I had in mind in the first place. But then, you know, I also mean, and I mean this in a non-denominational way, I mean to try to keep ourselves in everything that we do. Don't forget about ourselves. That's why I began the book, is I want people to be themselves. I want myself to be myself. You know, I want people to feel authentic and to feel connected to the things that they do, to not be part of that 82% where, you know, you're doing things all day that are meaningless to who you really are.
Yeah.
That's
soul destroying. It's utterly soul destroying.
Yeah, and so to bring your soul back into your daily experience and who you are.
Well, I love it. It's always so great talking with you, Dr. Cardillo. And the book is called 12 Rules of Attention, How to Avoid Screw-Ups, Free Up Headspace, Do More and Be More at Work. And that applies to life, too. And I know listeners can find out much more about you, Dr. Joe, at josephcardillo.com. So final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with. And, you know, and I guess I'd like to ask if you have any special words of advice on staying sane during these turbulent times and how we can begin to apply this to prepare for our new normal.
The best thing I can say to anybody is to pay attention to how you're paying attention. Just take a moment in the day. If even you're reading a paragraph in a book, see if you can you know, you look at the whole paragraph and see if you can intensify how much attention you're paying to one word. And so pay attention to how you're paying attention. You know, when you go in the elevator or when you're walking through a mall, what are you looking at? Why are you looking at those things? Just play with that idea. It's actually fun. You get to know how your mind is working and what's swaying your mind one way or the other, because, you know, all of a sudden you say to yourself, wow, that's what I'm looking at. I wonder why.
Right. Well, I know people can find out, as I said, much more about you at josephcardillo.com. Anything you'd like to say about the book that we haven't discussed? We've kind of bounced around a lot because there's so much information in there. I wanted to pull out what I needed help with.
Well, I think, you know, I thought about it for years. This is actually the second book I've written on attention. And I thought about it for years. I've taught over 20,000 students. And so I see young people, people that are, you know, early in their careers headed out to do more. And I really, you know, I just want to say that attention is behind it all. What we pay attention to is driving everything that we do. So if somebody's having good luck, take a look at how they're paying attention to something. If you're experiencing a series of bummers, take a look at what you're paying attention to. And it's even connected to our health beyond just depression and other, you know, anxieties and stressors. And I think that, you know, I was talking to some of the people on my team just about 2 hours ago, and I think that it's, you know, attention is really a serious matter for people who are recovering from anything as well, recovering from anything from cancer to addictions to interpersonal relationships that went awry. I think attention is vital in getting us back on track, and it's even vital in that segue where we're not quite on track, we're going to get on track, and then it's vital in keeping us on track with who we are as people, you know, as getting our soul back, people, and flowing forward with a happy mind. I think it's everything. After writing 7 books on mind, body, health, I think that attention is at the core of it all.
Well, I love it. And as always, I appreciate your wisdom and sharing your expertise with us. The book, again, is called 12 Rules of Attention. Dr. Joe Cardillo, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I love your show. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I want to thank each of you for joining us today. If you have comments, feedback, or questions on today's conversation, you can reach me at conversationslive.net. We have over 1,000 guest interviews and more than 700 podcasts at conversationslive.net. And you can chat with me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. Hope you'll tune in next week. Until then, please stay safe, stay strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicky's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.